Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present syndicated columnist and author Robert Scheer, who assesses the truthfulness of Condoleezza Rice's testimony before the 9/11 Commission and the current military situation confronting U.S. troops in Iraq. Burke Stansberry, Program Director at CSPACE, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, who explains how Washington influenced the outcome of recent presidential elections in that impoverished Central American nation. And Catherine Kim, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, who discusses a class action lawsuit challenging the U.S. government's no-fly list. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that newly declassified documents show that China was a key player in the recently exposed Pakistani-sponsored black market for nuclear weapons. The records dating from 1965 to 1997 show that China blunted U.S. inquiries into nuclear proliferation while at the same time aiding Pakistan's program to build nuclear weapons. Even now, the CIA has been unable to conclude that China has cut all its ties to nations seeking to build nuclear weapons. Just 2 weeks before the documents were released in March, U.S. Undersecretary of State John Bolton flew to Beijing and defended China's leadership, saying that despite past mistakes, the Asian nation was now cooperating to stop nuclear proliferation. Yet many observers doubt that the Bush administration can put much pressure on China to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. Currently, China has a $150 billion trade surplus with the U.S., and China has invested $350 billion in U.S. Treasury bills. By doing so, China is an important player in financing the huge Bush fiscal deficit. In recent weeks, China has also announced that it will help Pakistan build a nuclear power plant in Chashma, Pakistan. The Bush administration has opposed the deal, but China says the plant is for civilian use only and doesn't violate its 1996 commitment to withhold support for nuclear plants that are not subject to international inspections. Western intelligence believes that China has regularly broken its promises on proliferation, including assisting the flow of nuclear technology to North Korea. During the congressional debate on creating the Department of Homeland Security, Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro offered an amendment to stop the new federal agency from granting contracts to U.S. companies that incorporate overseas in order to dodge American taxes. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the DeLauro measure was blasted by the House GOP leadership as a detriment to creating jobs, but the amendment passed by a wide 318 to 110 margin in the House. A similar amendment, authored by the late Senator Paul Wellstone, passed the U.S. Senate a few weeks later. The administration has never supported these measures, and the U.S. Treasury Department blamed the problem on a distorted tax code and not on corporate greed. A new study by the General Accounting Office has renewed the debate over companies moving their headquarters overseas. It found that 60% of all U.S. corporations did not pay any federal taxes from 1996 to 2000. In 2003, corporate taxes accounted for only 7.4% of all tax receipts, an all-time low. Since the Homeland Security Bill was signed into law in November 2002, a number of politically connected corporations have moved jobs overseas. This includes Dick Cheney's old firm Halliburton, which has 20 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. Large finance companies like Citibank and Merrill Lynch have also moved their private banking units for wealthy individuals to offshore tax havens. An expected 7.6 million people will turn off their television sets between April 19th and April 24th during TV Turnoff Week. The organizers at TV Turnoff Network say over 19,000 organized turnoffs are planned in every state as well as in several nations abroad. The 10th annual celebration promotes turning off the TV, which cuts into family time and impedes children's ability and desire to read. The network says children this year in the United States will spend 1,023 hours in front of the TV and 900 hours in school. Healthy and active lifestyles is the special focus this year to steer adults and children into being more involved with screen-free activities. Executive Director Frank Vespi said, "We urge kids and adults to turn off the TV and to get up and go. TV Turnoff Network is a nonprofit organization founded in 1994 that believes people should not wait for better TV when we can turn it off and reclaim time for our families, our friends, and for ourselves. For more information, visit the TV Turnoff Network's website at www.tvturnoff.org. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Jeanette Nowak. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As violence in Iraq exploded last week, the nation turned its attention to the testimony of President Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice before the commission investigating the September 11th attacks. Under oath, Dr. Rice confirmed the existence of a classified August 6, 2001 presidential daily briefing, which was ominously titled, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S." Although the National Security Advisor characterized the document as historical and not warning of specific threats from al-Qaeda, later declassification of the briefing paper revealed intelligence indicating that al-Qaeda was active in the United States and making preparations for the possible hijacking of airplanes. Meanwhile, in escalating attacks on coalition forces in Iraq, insurgents battled U.S. troops in the city of Fallujah, where 600 civilians and combatants are reported to have been killed. Armed militia groups loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr took over several cities after the U.S. sought the arrest of the young Muslim leader. Large numbers of American-trained Iraqi police and military have refused to fight, abandoned their posts, or joined the fighters challenging the U.S. occupation. In the past week alone, 70 U.S. soldiers have been killed, while insurgents have kidnapped dozens of foreign workers, including at least one American truck driver. In the face of growing instability in Iraq, U.S. Middle East Commander General John Abbasade has asked the Pentagon for 15,000 to 20,000 more troops. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with syndicated columnist Robert Scheer, who is a co-author of the book, The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. Scheer assesses the truthfulness of Condoleezza Rice's testimony before the 9/11 Commission and the current military situation confronting U.S. troops in Iraq.
The language of lying of this administration has been taken to an Orwellian art form. It's just words don't mean anything, you know, and it's been that way from the beginning. You know, 80% of the people believe Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and then these people in the ministry said, well, where did they get that idea from? You know, and yet they never mention 9/11 without mentioning Saddam Hussein, and it's always like that, the twisting. In her testimony, you know, about a document they didn't want to release, at a hearing they didn't want to have happen. I mean, it's the most amazing thing. Here you have the greatest tragedy on the mainland of the United States, and the most obvious thing would be to look into its origins. This administration, from the beginning, wasn't interested in having a bipartisan commission, then to try to appoint Henry Kissinger to be head of it, to, you know, the greatest manipulator in the world, and then it wouldn't cooperate, wouldn't turn over documents and so forth. And this is an example of a document they said they couldn't turn over because of national security. Well, there's no national security involved. What there is cover-up. And then she tried to dismiss it by saying it's a historical document. Well, by history, you mean something that happened before today. I suppose it is, but it basically undermined her main notion, which is that the threats that had been heard were all involved external locations. And as Benvenisi got it to admit before they even declassified the document, this was about planned bin Laden attacks on the United States and the existence of agents in the United States and explosives and the ability to do such actions. And so it was a clear refutation. I think she committed perjury. I'm not a lawyer, but it just seems to me she totally distorted the meaning of the document. And it does give the lie to the administration that they prepared us before 9/11, when we know from the O'Neill book, we know it from Clark's book, we certainly documented in our own Five Lies book, that they in no way prepared prepared us for terrorist attacks. They were preoccupied with the drug war and counter-missile weapons and Iraq. That was their focus, and they were actually indifferent to all the warnings that had come from the Clinton administration, Sandy Berg, and were coming with greater frequency and intensity right up through August about a terror attack on the United States.
As we've all witnessed an explosion of violence, rebellion, and uprisings throughout Iraqi society, the Sunnis, the Shias, and just seeming ordinary people are growing very hostile to the United States occupation. Maybe you can talk about what the reality is that the United States military is confronting now in Iraq, and does the Bush administration, in your view, have a plan to get out?
You know, I first went to Vietnam in 63 and 64, and I remember people even then telling me we couldn't just get out, okay? And I think we had 13,000 troops the first time I went. And in the movie Fog of War, McNamara is saying you can't just get out, and there were only 700. I shouldn't say only, there were 700 human beings, but there were 700 Americans that had been killed. And then 59,000 get killed, and you finally get out. And the best way to get out is to just leave. And there's a mechanism for getting out. You let the UN, the Arab League, NATO, combination thereof, people who know the language, people who know the religion, and you let them help that country attain stability. But certainly in the last week, we've seen the lie to the main argument against getting out, because we said there'd be a civil war and the Sunnis and the Shiites would kill each other. Well, the fact is, we have managed to unite the Sunnis and the Shiites. That is incredible. Our occupation has actually given rise to a nationalist fervor in Iraq, which has brought people together. And we're creating this insurgency. It's not being brought in by foreign agitators, and it's not a pro-Hussein. Nobody wants to bring Saddam Hussein back. People like freedom, but they want to define their freedom. They want to define it consistent with their religion, with their traditions, with their needs. And in a country that was artificially put together by colonial powers in order to better extract the oil, it's not going to be easy, you know, to figure out what form of government, because you have the Kurds, let's say, and you have two different forms of the Muslim religion. But I think what we've seen, at least with the Muslims, is that they can get along quite well. They're giving blood to each other. They're supporting each other. And even the Iraqi National Council, which is supposed to be our government that we put in, they're the ones that are complaining they weren't even consulted about this. And they're the ones that are trying to broker the ceasefire now, and to, because they know if they don't, they'll have no credibility with the Iraqi people. And what the Iraqi people have clearly said is they've had it with the occupation. They just had it with foreigners coming in into their houses and telling them how to live. But right now, I think in the actions of the last week, a basis is saying, look, these people clearly want to run their own country. That was the reason for going in. There are no weapons of mass destruction. That was the main reason for going in. So what's the reason for staying? And getting out doesn't mean we don't supply economic aid. It doesn't mean we don't work through the UN. It doesn't mean that we don't help the Arab League get in there. But there are, biggest mistake we made was going in unilaterally. And then trying to get contracts for the president's friends in Halliburton and Bechtel. And you got people roaming all over the country trying to cut deals like crazy, you know, so that the French and the Russians won't get back in. And you've got to separate. You've got to separate greed and the economic oil from the right of people to control their own history. And people want to make their own history. Sometimes they mess it up. Sometimes, you know, it can even be worse. But they have to make their own history. That's the main lesson here.
That was syndicated columnist Robert Scheer, who is a co-author along with Christopher Scheer and Lakshmi Chaudhry of the book The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, published by Seven Stories Press. Since the U.S.-supported war in El Salvador against a popular rebel movement led by the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or FMLN, ended more than a decade ago, news about the Central American nation has all but disappeared from the U.S. media. But Washington's influence in El Salvador has remained strong. ARENA, the party that has ruled El Salvador since 1989, has been tied to many of the massacres that occurred during the war, as well as to the 1980 assassination of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero and four American churchwomen. After the Civil War ended, the FMLN transformed itself from a guerrilla army to a political party and had recently won the largest number of seats in the National Assembly. Many observers believed that the FMLN had a chance to capture the presidency in elections held March 21st. But after the votes were counted, the ruling ARENA party had won by a margin of 57 to 36%. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Burke Stansberry, program director at CSPACE, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. He explains how the FMLN lost momentum in the final days of the campaign and what an FMLN victory would have meant for El Salvador.
There was tremendous energy that went into the campaign on the part of the FMLN party and so many of the different unions and organizations that supported them and people. It really was a time when there was a lot of hope that change was going to come, that this was the historical moment in which the FMLN was finally going to triumph through democratic elections. And as of early February of this year, the FMLN was basically in a statistical tie with the Arena Party. And at that point, a State Department official, Roger Noriega, the Assistant Secretary of State, went down to El Salvador and met with all of the presidential candidates except for Shafiq Kandel, the FMLN candidate, and made statements questioning the FMLN's democratic credentials, implying that the U.S. didn't approve of the FMLN and might not work with a potential FMLN government, and then imploring Salvadorans to vote for somebody who shared the convictions and or the values and beliefs of the U.S.
I heard there were threats that if the FMLN won, there would be a change in the way money is sent back to El Salvador by Salvadorans living in the U.S., which I guess is a high percentage of the total number of Salvadorans, right?
6 million Salvadorans live in El Salvador. 2 million live in the U.S., or over 2 million, and they send back about $2 billion a year in remittances to their families in El Salvador, and that money accounts for a huge percentage of the overall gross domestic product of El Salvador. And so the Salvadoran economy is basically dependent on Salvadoran workers living in the U.S. And so the issue of remittances and of immigration, U.S. immigration policy, is huge. And what the right wing was saying throughout the campaign, and there were commercials on television and radio and in the newspapers every day, saying that if the FMLN were to win, that money that comes back, that $2 billion, would effectively get cut off, and that many Salvadorans living in the U.S. would be deported. They had really no basis for these claims, but the U.S. government did nothing to counter the claims, and in that sense was totally complicit with that whole kind of fear misinformation campaign. And then right about 3 days before the elections, a U.S. congressman from Colorado came out and said that a number of congresspeople were interested in introducing legislation that would limit or control the flow of remittances should the FMLN win. So finally there was like a concrete threat.
So what happened on the day of the vote?
Well, it was amazing. I was there as an international observer, I think the third largest city, San Miguel, and had the experience of a lot of other people as well, that throughout the day there was a lot of hope. It looked really good for the FMLN. There were a lot of people out in the streets wearing red. There was a sense of excitement that the FMLN was going to win, and some of the early exit polls showed a very close race. But then once the polls actually closed and the vote count began, it proved to be a pretty overwhelming victory for the Arena Party. And it was about 70% voter turnout, and what a lot of people believe is that the FMLN doubled its number of votes from the previous election. So in that sense, their campaign was very successful. They got a lot of new voters out. But Arena, through the whole campaign of fear and propaganda, managed to inspire a lot of people who had never voted before to come out and basically vote against the FMLN out of fear, more than voting for Arena and any proposal that they had put forward.
Was actual fraud reported?
There was definitely fraud observed on election day, vote buying, and also various procedural anomalies. But most, I think the analysis from the FMLN and from a lot of folks in El Salvador is that it was really the U.S. intervention and the right-wing fear campaign that decided the elections even before election day.
There are Salvadoran troops in Iraq. Did that figure in the campaign?
It actually is a huge issue. It's about the Salvadoran government has about 400 troops in Iraq, so it's a small force, but it's part of the U.S.'s charade of having a coalition. And so El Salvador is one of those governments that did pledge troops, which was a very unpopular decision in El Salvador. And, yeah, the first Salvadoran troop died about a week and a half ago in Iraq. Yeah, I think that the FMLN candidate, Shafiq Ondal, had also pledged to pull the troops immediately out of Iraq should he win. You know, the FMLN has constantly said, we have nothing to do with this conflict, with this occupation, and our troops do not belong there. And certainly that was a point of contention for the U.S. as well.
That was Burke Stansberry of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Contact the group by calling area code 212-465-8115 or visit their website at www.cispes.org. Since the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., the U.S. government has compiled a list of thousands of individuals suspected of involvement in terrorist activities. At U.S. airports large and small, this list maintained by the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, has been used to detain and prevent these individuals from boarding commercial airliners. But many innocent passengers with names similar or identical to the names on the no-fly list have also been interrogated, searched, and prevented from flying. Now, the American Civil Liberties Union, representing seven U.S. citizens, has filed a class-action lawsuit challenging the regulations governing the no-fly list. The ACLU is demanding that the TSA remove innocent passengers' names from the list so that these citizens can fly without being detained or harassed. The airline passengers represented in the suit include a 36-year-old U.S. Air Force Master Sergeant, a 22-year-old Vermont College student, and a 74-year-old minister from Washington State. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Catherine Kim, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Legal Department, who discusses details of the lawsuit, including the charge that some on the no-fly list may have had their names placed there due to their political activities.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a nationwide class action lawsuit on behalf of innocent Americans who are repeatedly, time and again, treated as suspected terrorists virtually every time they board a plane, merely because of their name. And Scott, I'd like to emphasize here that these are innocent Americans. Among our seven named plaintiffs, for example, there is one Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force, there is one retired Presbyterian minister, there's a third-year college student, and there's no accusation that any of these individuals is guilty of any misconduct at all whatsoever. On the contrary, in several cases, the government itself has conceded that these passengers pose absolutely no threat to aviation security. And yet, virtually every time they want to board a plane, they're subject to delays, interrogations, sometimes by armed law enforcement, detentions, sometimes in a separate interrogation room for up to 3 hours. And the worst part of it is, Scott, is that there's no way for these innocent passengers to clear their names and thereby avoid being treated like a suspected terrorist again and again virtually every time they fly. I'd also like to note that these passengers' names are about as common as you can imagine. For example, one of our named plaintiffs is named David Nelson, another is Michelle Green. But individual passengers have been told, well, I'm sorry, we have to get FBI clearance because your name is similar to one wanted by the FBI. But I will emphasize, though, that the federal government has maintained incredible secrecy around the no-fly list.
There are members of the Green political party here in the United States, as well as some other peace activists who have participated in anti-war activity in the last year or two who feel they have been targeted simply because of that activity. Have you been able to investigate in any way if that activity is indeed the reason they're on the lists?
Well, in terms of investigation, the Northern California affiliate of the ACLU did file a FOIA request for information, and that FOIA request was on behalf of two anti-war protesters who missed their flight because of the no-fly list. They were told, you know, because of the no-fly list, I'm sorry, but we're not able to process your boarding passes. The government refused to provide information, and that litigation to force the government's hand to disclose this information is still pending. you know, it is our hope that with the FOIA request, in addition to our affirmative challenge to the no-fly list, not only will we be able to get some remedy for these innocent folks, but also to have the government held accountable for what it's doing to these people.
What demands are you making through this class action lawsuit against the U.S. government and the no-fly list? What result would you like to see occur?
That's a very good question, Scott. At this point, I mean, we really don't have enough information from the government, and it is our position that it's not our place as the ACLU or on behalf of our plaintiffs, it's not our place to dictate to the government exactly what they should be doing to remedy the problem. I mean, we would be satisfied so long as they provide a remedy, some sort of remedy, that comports with the due process protections and Fourth Amendment protections of the U.S. Constitution.
You're looking for a way that innocent folks or people who have not committed any crime or are in no way affiliated with the terrorist groups and the like can get their names off these lists, some process.
Exactly. Exactly. Among the two claims we raise in the legal complaint is, first, a procedural due process violation, meaning there is currently no process for these innocent passengers to clear their names. So as a result, virtually every time they board a plane, they are basically treated as a suspected terrorist. And the second legal claim would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. Again, that would be remedied by some sort of procedural process wherein the individual wouldn't be subject to an unreasonable search or seizure because the individual would have an opportunity to clear his or her name.
Now, how would you answer those who support the list and support the secrecy by maintaining that after September 11th, you know, there may be some innocent victims in all this, but it's going to be necessary because the government has to remain covert in terms of how it's acting and why it's acting as it does with these no-fly lists?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are, again, sensitive to the need for national security, but again, it is our position that this is not good for security, and it not only is it not worth it to trade off civil liberties of this magnitude, but when an individual is treated like a suspected terrorist again and again and again, even after the government has confirmed their identity and said, yes, you are not a security risk, and yet they continue to be subject to such treatment, that is absolutely bad for national security.
That was Catherine Kim, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at www.aclu.org, where you can report incidents involving your own experiences dealing with the no-fly list. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Jeanette Nowak, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.